The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to kuci.org. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 in Irvine. Welcome to In the Garden with UC Master Gardeners. I am Katrina Kirkaby, your Master Gardener host today. I have to tell you, I'm really excited about our show and our guest, Ernest Miller. Vegetable gardens are often produced in abundance of produce this time of year, and we'll be talking about one of the options for your produce. Actually, we're going to be talking about a lot of options, what we could do with our extra produce this year. As you may know, I'm also a UCCE Master Food Preserver. Yes, today's show will be on food preservation. We're very fortunate to have with us today Ernest Miller. Ernest is a chef, historian, educator, consultant, and speaker who teaches classes in museums, schools, and kitchens throughout Southern California. He has been called the Huell Hauser of California food. He is the co-lead of Slow Food Los Angeles. He is the co-leader of Soul Food Los Angeles, and he's also on the Speakers Bureau for the Culinary Historians of Southern California. He's formerly lead instructor for the Master Food Preservers of Los Angeles County and founder of RLM Provisions, LLC, a manufacturer of one of the best fermentation kits on the market. We are really lucky to have Ernest here today. I was so thrilled the first time that I heard him, I could not stop talking about food preservation when I got home. Welcome, Ernest. Thank you for being on our show today.
It's my pleasure to be here. I was trained as a master gardener in Los Angeles County, but I didn't keep up my volunteer hours recently. But I love gardening. I love food preservation. I love talking about it.
Ernest has such a passion about it. No matter where we go on the show today, and we're going to go to a lot of different places, he's just going to be able to, he's an educator, he has a historian about food, he has so many different concepts and thoughts about food preservation. He's going to keep us safe in what we're doing, and he's going to whet your appetite a little bit if it hasn't already been whetted about food preservation. Ernest, there's a lot of different types of preservation. Could you just go over a few, and then we'll start going in depth on many? What is preservation? What does it mean, and how does it apply to us in our everyday lives?
Well, generally, when we talk about food preservation, we're talking about preserving food without refrigeration, which is the common way most people preserve food nowadays. But the home refrigerator has only been around since the 1920s. It didn't become common until about World War II. And in many areas of the world today, refrigerators are not that common. So before the age of refrigeration, we had to preserve our food using many different techniques. Things like canning, pressure canning, freezing, drying, pickling, fermenting, curing, brewing, smoking, charcuterie, cheese making, bread baking, and also things like long-term food storage and emergency food preparedness, always important here in Southern California.
Oh my gosh, we could have a 10-week series of Ernest Miller on food preservation. It's going to be hard to choose what to talk about today. But I know this time of year, a lot of people are getting a lot of tomatoes out of their garden. And maybe we could spend some time talking about a little bit about tomatoes, preserving them, the types of preservation that's available, and really kind of how to do it.
Absolutely. And tomatoes are one of the most classic of preserved foods. I mean, the fresh tomatoes from the garden, I mean, there's nothing better than biting into a warm tomato, sun-warm, ripe, right out of your garden. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I'm getting some really nice tomatoes right now in my garden. Looking forward to tomato salad tonight. But if I want to enjoy those tomatoes, you know, in February, then I need to, you know, figure out some way to preserve them. Although here in Southern California, I actually had a couple tomato plants survive through the year.
You know, we're finding out they call it wintering over, and I can't. You have to have the right conditions to do that. Just segueing a little bit, and some gardeners have a lot of sun in an area that's protected, and they can winter over some tomatoes, and it's not as productive, but they get some. I'm not so lucky. I live on a north-facing hill, and I'm lucky I get tomatoes in the summertime. So for me, I have to depend on preservation if I want to have those great tasting tomatoes in the winter.
Absolutely. Well, preserving the tomatoes, probably the easiest one for everybody, requires no special equipment really, is to freeze them. Now, when you freeze the tomatoes, you don't want to freeze whole tomatoes. They're just going to become mushy balls, and you know, you're not going to get a good freezing anyway, freezing them whole. So what you want to do when you're freezing your tomatoes is you're going to want to chop them up into chopped tomatoes, or turn them into tomato sauce, and cook them for about 5 minutes at least to soften them. Then you want to put them in freezer bags, not storage bags, not sandwich bags, but freezer bags. And freezer bags are called freezer bags because they have a thicker plastic and they make an airtight seal so that you don't get any freezer burn. You're going to go ahead and cool off your tomatoes because, of course, once they're cooked, they're going to be hot. So you want to let them cool off to at least room temperature. Put them in the bags. Now, if you have a 1-quart bag, you want to only put 2 cups of tomato sauce in there. If you fill the bag to full 1 quart, it's going to be too full. It's going to have a hard time freezing. Of course, they make 1-gallon freezer bags. They even make 2-gallon freezer bags. So it's probably for if you got a really big family or a really big freezer. I like to freeze it in quart bags, 2 cups of tomato sauce at a time. First, you want to label your bags. This is incredibly important. When I teach a class on proper preservation for freezing, I tell people that the 3 most important things in freezing are, number 1, labeling. Number 2, labeling. And number 3, labeling.
And what are we labeling on that bag?
You're going to put the quantity of the product. So in this case, I'm going to write 2 cups crushed tomatoes, or 2 cups stewed tomatoes, or 2 cups tomato sauce, and the date.
And why is that important?
Well, it's very, very important.
I know why it's important, but I don't know if our audience knows why it's important.
Well, once things are frozen and been in the freezer for a little bit, it's hard to tell what they are. Is it crushed tomatoes, or is it tomato sauce? Or is it strawberries? It's red. I'm not sure. So you need to know what it is. I put the quantity so I know how much of it there is. So 2 cups tomatoes. That way I can use it in my recipe. And if I'm doing a bigger dinner, then I'll just pull out a couple packages so I get 4 cups or whatever I need. And then finally the date so that we know when it went in there so we can use it before the quality degrades too much. You know, people use their freezers to just throw things in there, and chances are a lot of your audience has something that's been in there for a couple of years.
Now, how long would you say, once you do that, how long would you say the tomatoes are good in your freezer?
Well, they're not going to go bad necessarily, but the quality will degrade. So you're going to want to use them within 6 months on the one hand. On the other hand, they're not bad, so if you're getting past that 6-month period, feel free to use them. The quality may have degraded somewhat, but they'll still be safe to eat.
You know, I keep a marking pen in my top drawer in my kitchen because it just is, it helps me remember. And whenever I'm doing something, it could be anything, I always label before it goes in the freezer or the refrigerator because it just makes it that much more simple. Because I think I have a good mind, but it's amazing. A month or two or 3 or 4 goes by and I pull it out. I'm like, what the heck is that? Exactly what you said. And
absolutely.
Then I don't have to worry about remembering it.
Absolutely. You know, when I teach classes, you know, cooking classes or at culinary schools, I'll ask the students, I'll say, what's the most important tool in the kitchen? And they'll say a knife, cutting board. The most important tool is a Sharpie.
Sharpie.
Label.
I love that. Absolutely love that. Okay, so once we're...
Oh, and by the way, one thing, you got to label the bags before you put the tomato sauce in. It's a lot harder to write on a bag of squishy tomato sauce than it is to, you know, write on an empty bag.
Yeah, you know, I find that with anything because the ink doesn't seem to work so well on a more of a moist bag. Once you have stuff in it, when it's dry and you just make up your label and put it in there, it's a heck of a lot easier.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And, you know, freezer bags will always have that white section on there, easy place to write down what you need to write down.
So we got tomatoes and we have freezing tomatoes, and now we could take just, it's a real simple thing to do. You don't have to have any equipment except for a pot to cook it in for a little bit, and now you have it in the refrigerator or freezer. What else do you recommend doing to preserve your tomatoes?
Well, drying tomatoes. is, you know, a fantastic way of concentrating their flavor, reducing their size, making them shelf stable so you don't have to keep them in the freezer because, you know, your freezer gets full pretty quickly if you're just freezing tomatoes.
Now, when you say drying tomatoes, not everybody knows what you're talking about. What does drying tomatoes mean and how do you go about doing it?
Well, the food preservation technique is called dehydration. And we're removing water from our product. Of course, you dehydrate fruits and vegetables and meats. It's called beef jerky. Mm-hmm. And by removing the water, then mold, yeast, and bacteria are unable to grow because mold, yeast, and bacteria need water in order to grow. It's actually a little more complex than that because things can actually have moisture in them. They can have water in them. But if the water is bound up with other chemicals, then although the water is there, mold, yeast, and bacteria still cannot grow. And the classic examples of this are honey, which is moist. I mean, honey's a liquid, generally, but it doesn't go bad. In fact, honey can stay good for hundreds of years. We've discovered honey in tombs that's still good. But this is because the water molecules in the honey are bound up with the sugar and are unavailable to the bacteria. Same thing with raisins. A properly dried raisin is still moist and chewy, not crispy and dry. That's because the moisture left in the raisin is bound with the sugars in what was formerly a grape, so the mold, yeast, and bacteria cannot grow. So it's a little more complicated. But in the case of tomatoes, we're going to remove the water. Mold, yeast, and bacteria will not grow, and then properly stored in an airtight container, preferably in the dark, at room temperature, they can last 6 months to a year. And again, you're concentrating flavors, so they're fantastic, and you're reducing the size and the weight, so they don't take up as much space.
That's wonderful. Now, could you tell us a little bit about, some people say, do I have to have a dehydrator to do this? Can I do it in my oven? Can you do these in both places?
Absolutely. And if you have the right conditions, you can actually do it out in the sun. That's why they call them sun-dried tomatoes.
Ah.
As a matter of fact, most of the fruit and vegetable drying that you buy in the stores is done by the sun. Our raisin industry is based on the wonderful dry heat of the Central Valley here in California. The vast majority of raisins are going to be sun-dried. So with the right atmospheric conditions, meaning temperatures above 80 degrees, humidity levels low, then you can dry your tomatoes out in the sun, which of course is the cheapest. You want to put them on some sort of rack so they get air circulation. You're going to want to cover them so they're not available to the birds and the insects. But I know people who do sun-dried tomatoes on their rooftops. Obviously, once again, if you're living in a coastal area where there's a lot of moisture, it's not going to be useful. But if you're in the Palm Desert, you're in luck.
Yeah. You can. And most of us around here, a lot of us don't have a lot of room to do it outside, but we can do it in our ovens, and we might not have a dehydrator. But it's something that can we turn our ovens on low? What would you recommend to do?
Absolutely. A lot of the modern oven brands actually have dehydration settings nowadays.
Really?
So you can go ahead and do that if you've got a modern oven.
You can probably have an old one.
Well, and not all new models do, but if that's something you're interested in when you're looking to replace your stove eventually, check it out. They do have dehydration settings, which is kind of cool. But we can always do oven dehydration. And so once again, you're going to want to put your fruit or vegetables, or in this case tomatoes, on a rack. Put them in your oven. Now, we generally consider dehydration to take place below 140 degrees Fahrenheit. If it's above 140 degrees Fahrenheit, we consider that cooking. Now, your oven may be at 140 degrees or lower, and again, we generally have to be above 100 degrees or so, 95 minimum, for dehydration to take place. But if you have an old gas oven, for example, the pilot light alone may keep the temperature perfect at 120 degrees. How do you know this? Well, you should have an oven thermometer. Everybody should have an oven thermometer, whether you're doing dehydration or not. They cost about $6 at the hardware store. And you can find out whether or not your oven is calibrated. When was the last time you calibrated your oven? Your oven could easily be 25 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit off, and you wouldn't know it. You know, that's why things always have to take longer, or they go too quickly, and you burn those cookies all the time. If it's off by more than 25 degrees, then I'd make a maintenance call. Call Southern California Gas if it's a gas oven. They'll come out and fix it, calibrate it for you for free.
Really?
But we want to have the temperature between 100 and 140 degrees. Now, if your oven is too warm, at that temperature, or if it's not a gas oven, you put it at the very lowest temperature setting, and if that's too warm for an electric oven, for example, then you're going to crack the oven door open. Use a towel to wedge the door open, and then check that thermometer. You may have to wedge the door more or less open, make adjustments, wait 15 minutes every time you make an adjustment so the heat can equalize. Once you've gotten it to where the temperature is between 100 and 140 degrees, then you can dehydrate your vegetables in the oven, which if you're only doing it a couple times a year, is a very efficient way, and you don't have to buy another piece of equipment to do it.
It also might be a bit hot this time of year to leave that oven cracked, though.
Well, sacrifices have to be made.
Yes, yes, yes. And then I have a dehydrator, and that just seems to make it really simple for me. I do a lot of vegetables, and I have mine out on the deck. And just what do you do? Just put them right there on the racks of the dehydrator and turn it on and let it go?
Pretty much. Now, if you're interested in dehydration, and you can do a lot of dehydration, then a dehydrator is a nice purchase. They tend to be very efficient, but there's several things to look for. Number one, if you're first starting, one of the best things to look for is your local garage sale. You know, somebody got a dehydrator, they were watching the late night infomercial, and they used it once and never used it again. You can usually get a really good bargain on those. Now, they may not be the best dehydrator in the world, but they're a good place to get started with just a little money. And once you figure out that you like dehydration, then you can invest in a more sophisticated dehydrator. If you really like dehydration, I recommend a box-type dehydrator with variable temperature control and a timer, so that you can set the time. So you can set your dehydration to go off to work or sleep through the night, and it'll turn off automatically for you. If it doesn't have a timer, you can always get an appliance timer in a hardware store and do basically the same thing. But it's very simple to go ahead and put your dehydrator out on the porch or something, especially during the summer, so it doesn't heat up the house. It's not fighting your air conditioner, on the one hand. On the other hand, if you're doing dehydration in the cooler times, why not keep it in the house? I often will dehydrate stuff just to make my house smell good, because dehydrators will often provide an aroma, for example, dehydrated apples or dehydrated orange slices, and fill my house with wonderful scent. Of course, if I'm dehydrating garlic or onion, then definitely outside, so that, you know, you just go ahead and put it outside. Now, for tomatoes, in general, you're just going to go ahead and slice them, usually about a quarter inch thick or so, and then dehydrate them on the racks in the dehydrator. For grape or cherry tomatoes, you want to cut those in half and dehydrate them as halves. Now, for homemade dehydrated tomatoes, the recommendation is to dehydrate them till crisp. So then you're going to be storing them at room temperature crisp. Now, a lot of people like those chewy, sun-dried tomatoes that are stored in olive oil. And I'm sorry to tell you, but the USDA does not recommend doing that at home. When you do certain food preservation processes at an industrial scale, you have more temperature controls, you have scientific testing to make sure everything is safe. We generally don't have those abilities at home. So if you want to dry tomatoes for storage at room temperature, then you're going to dry them to a crisp. However, if you want to make those chewy sun-dried tomatoes, those leathery sun-dried tomatoes, what you can do is dehydrate the tomatoes till they're leathery. You can then store them in the freezer. You can even put them in olive oil and then store them in the freezer for that quality. Now, one of the things that I like to do is when I dry my sun-dried tomatoes to a crisp in my dehydrator, is just before I use them, I might put them in olive oil in the refrigerator for a day or two in the refrigerator, so the olive oil picks up some of that flavor, which I can then use, and the tomatoes rehydrate a little bit. They don't get quite leathery like you may be used to, but they do a really great job. So it's very simple to dehydrate tomatoes, which actually brings us to the question of what sort of tomatoes and stuff to dehydrate.
That was my next question. I didn't know there's better tomatoes to dehydrate than others, so could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, for both canning and dehydration, the type of tomatoes that you want to use are your meatier tomatoes. You want to use your plum tomatoes, your pear tomatoes that have a lot more meat. Your more watery varieties, many of your heirloom varieties, have a lot of water in them. Now, you can dehydrate them. It's just going to take longer, and there's going to be less result because they're more watery. Whereas your much more meaty tomatoes, you're going to have that more oomph. And particularly if you want to make like leathery tomatoes and stuff, it's going to work better with your plum aroma tomatoes for dehydration. But again, you can dehydrate any variety. It's just that the meatier tomatoes are going to give you a better quality product at the end.
Gotcha. Now, you mentioned leather. What do you think about like tomatoes and leather?
Oh, so a leather.
And what is a leather?
Yeah, a leather is a dehydrated product of a puree. And so we're going to go ahead and make a puree. We're going to put it on a leather drying sheet, because if you put it on a rack, the puree is just going to drip through and not going to have any product. So it's a solid thing. They sell them with the dehydrators, whether it's a round dehydrator or box-type dehydrator. Usually they send you a couple when you buy a new one, and you can buy additional as you need them. We use these with fruits, and we call them fruit roll-ups. But you can also do them with tomato products. You can also do them with a wide variety of other fruits and vegetables. You can make things like ketchup leather. You can make things like salsa leather. Using unique flavors and textures, intense flavors that you can use for garnishing, or you can even put things like ketchup leather right on a sandwich. Or a hamburger.
Really?
Absolutely. I like to make salsa leathers, and I'll chop them up. I'll sprinkle them into a salad, or I'll put them in tortilla soup. They'll be a little chewy. They'll start to dissolve, and you get an immense amount of flavor. Tomatoes by themselves tend to dry very crisp and crackly, and so when you make a tomato puree and dehydrate it, you can then make tomato powder out of it, which you can garnish with. If you want to make a tomato leather, you're going to have to add some other ingredients to it, like rice flour or cornstarch or other vegetables that are going to allow you to make a pliable leather as opposed to a very crispy chip. Oh, which, by the way, making crisp tomato chips is fantastic, because you can use those in place of, like, say, potato chips or stuff, or make really wonderful appetizers with crisp tomato chips.
Oh, that sounds great. I'm taking notes. I'm going to do that one at home.
Well, it's your imagination is the only limit. Food preservation doesn't have to be just boring. You can be incredibly creative with it. Like, for example, say you do a tomato puree and you dry it to a crisp, no other ingredients. You put it in your spice grinder, grind it to a powder. Now you can sprinkle tomato flavor all sorts of different places and use it in a garnish. And, using deviled eggs, usually we put paprika on top of them for color. Paprika doesn't have a huge amount of flavor. Why not use your tomato powder that you made?
Oh, absolutely yummy. We could do a whole segment just on leathers, and it sounds wonderful.
Don't get me started on dehydration here. Well, you kind of did. You can buy garlic powder in the store, but it tends to be very flavorless. If you're growing your own garlic, or you're getting a good source of fresh garlic from your farmer's market, you can dehydrate your own garlic, make your own garlic powder. It's like 10 times as flavorful. Make your own onion powder.
Okay, we're going there. Tell us how to do it. This is great. How do we do that?
Well, with your garlic, you're going to want to chop it up a bit, slice it thin. You're going to put it on your trays, dry it to a crisp. If you chop it really small, put it on a leather sheet, dry it to a crisp, grind it, and now you've got garlic powder. And super intense in flavor. Absolutely amazing. I used to do this in my restaurant sometimes because what would happen is, we'd buy the peeled garlic as a labor-saving device from Gilroy, of course, not any of that Chinese garlic or anything, which, by the way, really doesn't taste that good. Gilroy garlic capital of the world for a reason. They amazing garlic. But if we had leftover garlic that weren't going to use quick enough, then we'd dehydrate it and make our own garlic powder. Absolutely amazing and intense. Onion powder. Basically, you're going to just julienne the onion, quarter inch thick. You can do slices or whatnot. You can dehydrate it to crisp, grind it to onion powder. Much better than the stuff you buy in the store. But here's the thing. You can do other alliums as well. So, leeks. I mean, have you seen leek powder recently?
No.
You could probably buy it from a specialty store, but if you've got an abundance of leeks, which happens on occasion, you can dehydrate those to crisp and grind those into leek powder. Of course, you can make shallot powder. You can make these wonderful things that you wouldn't have in the store, would be expensive, and the flavor is absolutely amazing. So imagine you have mashed potatoes, and you just sprinkle some leek powder on top as a garnish.
Oh, my goodness.
you know, and it's an obviously wonderful flavor combination. And, you know, a great way to take advantage of the, you know, leek bounty you may have had in your garden or the great deal you got at the farmer's market.
Oh, my God. Yeah, just, and you could also do it as presents, too, couldn't you? Just to,
absolutely.
If you get a whole bunch of it, you could just put them in jars and give them out at the holidays or for little homemade presents of different kind of seasonings.
Absolutely.
And it comes from the heart and it's homegrown and it's fresh. Oh, my goodness, what an idea.
Yeah, so dehydration is do amazing things. A fun thing I like to do, dehydrate carrots, grind them to powder, sprinkle them on ice cream.
No.
It's colorful and the carrots are sweet. And, you know, now you can kind of claim it's kind of a healthy dessert.
Oh, there we go. Tell me about fruit leathers.
Well, fruit leathers are, of course, absolutely amazing. The ones you buy in the store, of course, loads of sugar. You know, they use as little fruit as they can possibly get away with, you know, preservatives and everything else. But again, we're making a fruit leather. We're going to go ahead and puree our fruit. You're generally going to actually want to add some sweetener to it. It's going to help with the texture. It's going to help with the color. But you don't have to add huge amounts. And you can do it to your taste. And you also have to remember that as you dry the leather, the flavor is going to concentrate. So even when you taste the puree and it's not super sweet, that sweetness will concentrate as it begins to dry. Now, once again, some fruits are not going to make a pliable leather. So there are ingredients you can add like cornstarch or rice, but the one ingredient you can always add, which will always make your leathers pliable, is applesauce. And apples is pretty neutral. And depending on the fruit, you can find recipes online and guidelines, and you can experiment on your own. You know, to add a quarter cup, half cup of applesauce, not going to change the flavor that much. But then, you know, every fruit on the gamut is now your toy. And you can make, you know, various fruit combinations. Because you're not going to find, you know, peach blackberry leather at the supermarket. You can also put other flavorants in there as well, different extracts. For example, maybe a little bit of almond extract or vanilla extract to give your leather a little different taste. Or you can go in a more adult direction and maybe add a little bit liqueur. Have you ever heard of daiquiri leather?
No, I haven't.
Well,
I have now.
You have now.
I have now. Daiquiri leather.
Yeah, absolutely. Think about adding a little bit of Cointreau or Chambord to a fruit leather. And then, you know, now you're serving some very interesting things at your next cocktail party or as appetizers for your adult friends.
Oh, my goodness. And they're so simple to do. You just put it, you talk about those pieces of, that you put it on, you just pour it on there and you put it in your dehydrator and set it and check it every so often. Do you ever turn it over?
It depends on the leather. Some leathers need to be turned over. Some do not. You're going to have to check them. It's going to take some little experiments. It's going to take some experience. But you can make some of the most amazing leathers. And then there are so many different ways to use them. It's not just, oh, I've got to eat a full fruit leather or something like that. But you use them in other dishes. You use them as garnish. You use them to wrap things. You cut it in strips and tie strings around stuff to, you know, hold it together in presentation.
I am getting a bounty of figs right now. What do you think about trying to do something with figs and leather? Is that a possibility?
Oh, absolutely. Well, dehydrated figs on their own are...
I mean fig chips, but I haven't tried to do anything else besides like fig chips, so maybe you could help me out here.
Well, first of all, I would like to start with the whole fig. Or in dehydration, probably the half fig would be a little bit easier for the home dehydrator. First of all, you want to treat the figs by pouring boiling water over them. And then I'm going to cut them in half, and I'm going to dehydrate the half figs all by themselves, you know, fig candy. Or then what I'm going to do is I'm going to make fig candy by dehydrating them by sprinkling them with flavor. For example, maybe a little microplaned lemon zest or microplaned orange zest. Or I'm going to dehydrate them, but before I dehydrate the half figs, I'm going to stuff them with an almond or 2 to 3 pistachios, or walnut. And then you eat the dehydrated fig, you got the beautiful nutty flavor. Or I'm going to go ahead and put a little bit of that Cointreau on there, or some other liqueur of which I am a fan, and then dehydrate them and so that they absorb some of that flavor of that, perhaps a little rose water.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, I am not done with figs, but I have to make a couple of station announcements. So let me quickly make those, and then we'll get back to figs because I am just having too much fun with this. What I need to let our audience know, it's that time of the show, that the opinions expressed on the show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to kuci.org. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 in Irvine. And this might also be a good time to give out some of our listening audience, some of our website information. You can also look the Master Gardeners of Orange County up on ucanr.org/MFPOC. We also have a helpline, and that's uccemfp@ucdavis.ed. Also, Ernest is on Facebook, and he's on Twitter, and he's on Instagram, and how you could find him and what he's doing and where he's doing and a lot of different aspects of what he does is at RLM Provisions. So you get RLM Provisions at Facebook, on Twitter, at Instagram, at Pinterest. He is part of, his company is Rancho La Merced Provisions, and I want to ask you a little bit more about that a little later, and just check him out too. He's a really good guy. He's got a lot of knowledge. I've learned a whole bunch from him, and just really, really professional, very thorough, and I'm really fortunate to have him here today. But back to our show, and tell me more about figs.
So your dehydrated half figs, you know, lend to a lot of creativity. You can also, you know, stuff them with candied fruit. So, for example, you've got your half fig and put some candied orange peel inside. You know, so a huge amount of options. You know, your imagination is the only limit.
Now, why would we pour boiling water over them to start with?
This is to soften their skins, to remove any of the sap from the figs. The sap of the fig can be an irritant to some people. Just as some people don't like latex gloves, the sap of the fig can be a skin irritant. And so we want to, not everybody is affected, but that helps, again, to soften the fig skins, remove any detritus, because they're dirty, they're dusty. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been out in...
On the tree.
On the tree. So that's why we want to go ahead and do that, pour some boiling water over them.
Gotcha. Another thing we have lots of during this time of year right now is squash. Can we dehydrate squash?
Absolutely, you can dehydrate squash. As a matter of fact, you can make things like pumpkin leather or kabocha leather, stuff like that. Of course, that's a cooking process, and then you're going to dehydrate the resulting cooked puree. But then, of course, you can sweeten it. Obviously, you can make pumpkin pie leather with, you know, nutmeg and cinnamon and a little bit of sugar in there.
Oh, my goodness. You know,
like
those
that.
Of us or those in the audience that have young children at home, those things are yummy to take to school with them. I also like to do leathers and send them to my husband at work, you know, just something healthy to snack on.
Well, you know.
That's the very basic things you could do, but there's just so much you can do with them, too.
Absolutely. I mean, for example, like a nice pumpkin leather, one that's not too sweet, like pumpkin pie that you might just eat by itself, but slightly sweetened, you can roll it around maybe some cream cheese. And you'll make a little, you know, appetizer or snack, a little roll-up or something like that. Or another classic would, of course, be take a fruit leather, like a strawberry leather or something like that, and then put some peanut butter in it and do a roll-up that way. Now you've got basically a peanut butter and jam roll-up for the kids. Or for the adults.
Yeah, I have a 63-year-old kid, I think, that's going to like that a lot.
Oh, absolutely. So, again, you can put those into to sandwiches or salads, you know, mix them into things, either chopped up or julienned. Again, you can use them to tie a nice bow around something for presentation that's just going to add some wonderful flavor. You know, I mean, dehydration is really underutilized, in my opinion.
I love it. You know, I also make zucchini chips. So those are kind of fun things. It's just a simple thing to do, you know, just slice them up real thin and I usually use, well, you could probably tell me what you use because it's always better than what I do. What do you
Well, no, I usually, very, very simple, just a little bit of oil, not too much. And the reason being is that oil actually holds moisture in. I've gotten a lot of questions from people, and they're doing dehydration, and I ask them, what's going on? Well, you know, I coated everything in oil. That's why it's not dehydrating very quickly, because the oil, I mean, that's we put oil on our skins to hold our moisture in, and so for the vegetables. And then, of course, a little bit of salt. And you have to remember that the flavors are going to concentrate. Mm-hmm. You know, what you might think of sprinkling a little bit of salt, turns out you're making super salty chips.
Yes.
You'll learn.
You'll learn. A little bit of practice. Oh, my goodness. There's so much to do on, you know, dehydrating. It's just, it's wonderful. I have a great time with it. You know, it's just, so, and it's simple and it's not hard to do. That's what I.
Absolutely not.
And the cleanup's easy and it's just not time consuming because it just, you just prep it and pretty much leave it. You know, sometimes you have to turn it over or change it, but it's really not a hard process to do at all.
Absolutely not.
When I have kids come visit me, that's one of the things we do, and they just—it's amazing. It's like it's another game for them. You know, it's just—it's more, and they're learning at the same time. And it's their leathers or my leathers, or how do we make this, and what can we mix together? And it's fun, and it's—they don't really know it's educational at the same time.
And also for our gardeners, dehydrators can be used for more than edibles as well. Now you want to be careful about cross contamination between things that you're going to eat. And things that you put in your dehydrator that aren't edible. But, you know, you got some of those wonderful flowers and stuff like that that are not edible, but you can dehydrate them and for your own potpourri or, you know, just for other decorative uses. With the kids, one of my favorite things to do is, you know, you may not have done this, you may have heard of it, is doing those shrunken apple heads. And you take the apple and you peel, you take the skin off and you dip it in lemon juice or fruit fresh and then you carve a face. And then you're going to go ahead and put it in a low oven, oven dehydration, of course, one of the ways to do it. But if you've got a dehydrator, you can put them in the dehydrator. And then they become those little shrunken apple-y heads, you know, that you used to see in the fall before. And people make them little dolls or little Halloween dioramas and things.
Oh, how fun. Oh, well, God, I'm so glad we went in this direction because it's just, it's one of my favorite things to do, and thank you so much. And I think we started this all off with tomatoes. And why don't we go back and talk, because we are getting a lot of tomatoes right now, and talk a little bit about preserving tomatoes and what not to do and maybe some pressure canning and other ways to preserve some tomatoes with our harvest that we're getting right now.
Oh, well, you know, I think canning is probably my favorite way of preserving tomatoes. Although freezing is very simple, requires no exception equipment, you know, freezers get full. And so, you know, one of the best ways to store an abundance of tomatoes would be at room temperature if they're properly canned. Now, the first thing is you can can any sort of tomatoes that you want. But I have think that the best way to can tomatoes is to have to grow tomatoes strictly for preservation. And to grow the right varieties of tomatoes for preservation. And what I recommend is, again, growing your meatier tomatoes, your sauce tomatoes, your Romas, your plums, your San Marzanos, and making sure they're determinate varieties, not indeterminate. Now, your indeterminate tomato plant is going to provide tomatoes on an irregular basis. And this is absolutely fantastic for you to go out in your garden on a daily basis, grab a tomato for a sandwich, grab a tomato for a salad, grab a tomato, you know, fresh tomatoes to put on your tomato sauce or pizza or something like that. But you're going to get little tomatoes throughout the time. This is not great for preserving. Why? Because you end up making like 2-pint jars of tomato sauce at a time, and going through the canning process, while not very difficult, well, requires some setup and some stuff, and if you're only doing 2 jars at a time, it's not terribly efficient. So what you want to do is have determinate tomatoes that will give you a window of when they're all going to come ripe at once, and these are going to be your canning tomatoes, so that, you know, you plan, so first of all, you're not out on vacation when they're planning to be ripe, because usually they'll tell you 60-day tomatoes, 70-day tomatoes, 90-day tomatoes, so you have some idea when they're all going to come ripe all at once, and then you put aside some time on a weekend or whenever you have the opportunity, and then you're going to can your pints and quarts all at once, so you're more and more efficient with your canning. And again, your meatier canning tomatoes, You can do the heirloom tomatoes, but a lot of the wonderful flavors and aromas of the heirloom tomatoes only come from the fresh tomato. Once you start to cook them, particularly cooking for a long time, as in the canning process, you're going to lose some of those particular aromas that make the Cherokee so good, mm-hmm. for example. It's just going to taste like any other tomato once it's been canned. You're not going to see any of that difference. On the one hand. On the other hand, you can also do really cool stuff. Like I like to can tomato juice. And of course, you've got your beautiful red tomato juice. But I also can Sungold tomato juice from Sungold cherry tomatoes. Sweet, delicious, bright yellow. So a fantastic, and you're serving a nice breakfast or brunch for your family or friends, instead of giving them orange juice, why not a little small shot of Sungold tomato juice? Sweet and delicious. Of course, you know, you can also do green zebra juice and, you know, nice green tomato juice that's going to taste, you know, delicious as well. So again, there are exceptions, but I generally, for most canning purposes, for your stewed tomatoes, your crushed tomatoes, your tomato sauces, then I'm going to recommend a determinant meaty variety for best preservation. But again, you can can any type of tomato. You're just going to get best results that way.
Great. And if people haven't done it, they can. We actually offer classes to the public, which is kind of a nice thing to do. It's kind of a big thing to take on, and sometimes it could feel a little bit daunting. So if our listening audience here has never canned before, you can also take a canning class from the UC Master Gardeners. And again, let me give you our web address. It's ucanr.org/MFOPOC. And our helpline is uccemfp@ucdavis.edu. So go ahead, look at our, and if you can't remember all that, look up Master Gardeners of Orange County, excuse me, I'm also a Master Gardener, look up Master Food Preservers of Orange County, and we'll have classes that you could take so you could learn how to do it safely, and we have a variety of classes out there, and canning, it's so nice to be able in January or February to open a homemade can of tomatoes and have that fresh taste just coming into your kitchen in the wintertime.
The taste of August and September.
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful. Is there any what not to do's in canning?
Well, absolutely. So you want to take a canning class if you've never done it before, because it is certainly possible for it to go wrong and go disastrously wrong, even deadly wrong.
Now, Ernest knows, and he is one of the top people on canning, but trying to tell people how to can over the radio is really difficult, if not impossible. So we're just trying to heighten your intrigue, you know, heighten your liking of doing this, and then come on over and do a class. But there's some things we can do wrong. So why don't you give us some things that people can think about?
Okay. Well, first of all, when you're canning tomatoes, you always want to use a tested and improved recipe by the USDA. The reason for this is that a lot of the recipes that people have put out on the internet that grandma used to make are not necessarily safe. Even though grandma may have made it for years and there was never any problem, she was just rolling the dice. And tested and approved USDA recipes are going to ensure that you're going to have a safe product. A lot of times people want to can things like salsas and things of this nature. The problem is salsas are going to contain ingredients that are non-acidic. And the acid level in our product is incredibly important to the safety. In fact, the acid level is what controls the Clostridium botulinum to a large degree, particularly in water bath canning. So even though grandma used to make a delicious, delicious tomato salsa with fresh onions and bell pepper and, you know, different things, it may not be safe to can. So you want to use a tested and approved recipe. Indeed, with tomatoes, we're so concerned about the acid level. Now, tomatoes can be borderline acid fruits, which they are technically. And once again, the acid level in our canning process is critically important. Some tomatoes are simply not acidic enough for our product to be safe to can. There are certain varieties of tomatoes, for example, the Momotaro, a Japanese variety, that are a low acid variety, very sweet, delicious, but because it's low acid, not safe to can. There are other varieties of tomatoes that may normally be acidic, but depending on the growing conditions, The acid level in the tomato never properly develops, and thus the tomato is not necessarily safe to can. So what the USDA recommends is whenever canning a tomato product, like a tomato juice, tomato sauce, crushed tomatoes, stewed tomatoes, half tomatoes, full tomatoes, all this sort of thing, is always to acidify the tomatoes. And we acidify the tomatoes either by adding citric acid or by adding lemon juice. And in this case, we want to use a commercial bottled lemon juice. And the reason for this is that the commercial bottled lemon juice is a known acidity, so that we ensure that we have the proper acid level in our tomatoes for safety. So we don't want to just go use any old recipe out there that we find on the internet that grandma gave us or from some old book. We want to make sure that we're going to a good, reliable source. And, of course, one of the best places to ask for good, reliable sources is the Master Food Preserver Program here in Orange County. You can also go to the National Center for Home Food Preservation, which is at the University of Georgia. That's always USDA-approved recipes. You can go to the USDA website itself. The USDA has a publication called Home Canning that obviously tells you exactly what to do.
Yeah, the bottom line here is be safe. Oh, my gosh, that sounds... It's wonderful, and it's a great time of year. Question for you. I've heard some things about hatch chilies. Is this something that you feel like talking about a little bit?
Absolutely. You know, some of my family on my father's side is from Columbus, New Mexico. That's where my father grew up. I have aunts and uncles that grew up and lived in Hatch. There's actually a small statue to one of my relatives in Hatch, New Mexico.
Oh, I'm impressed.
My family's been eating Hatch, New Mexico chilies as long as I can remember, long before they became popular and hip and everything like that. They were shipping them to my family here in Southern California. And I remember my great-grandfather, when he got those Hatch chilies, he'd start roasting them over a stove on his back porch that they normally didn't use for any cooking. I mean, in fact, the only cooking I remember them using it for was big family gatherings and roasting Hatch chilies. And we'd go there and we would get those first Hatch chilies. We'd peel them, put them between two slices of bread with a little bit of mayonnaise and salt, and then Hatch chili sandwiches. And then, of course, we'd use them for a lot of other things. So I'm a huge fan of the Hatch chili. Also a fan, however, of the Anaheim chili, which is a direct descendant and cousin of the famous Hatch chili. And, of course, late August is Hatch chili season. Now you can get them at a wide variety of supermarkets. I remember several years ago, it's become much more popular now, so it's not quite as much trouble. But when they would show up at certain supermarkets, people would start lining up at 2 or 3 in the morning
really?
In order to get the Hatch chilies. Absolutely. But now so many more supermarkets are doing it, it's very simple to... You know, you don't have to stand at line at 2 in the morning in general. But then, of course, there are many different ways to preserve the Hatch chili because it's such a short season that, you know, the fresh chili is absolutely wonderful, but then you want to be able to enjoy them throughout the year. And you can can them. They must be canned in a pressure canner. You can, of course, freeze them. And the best way, of course, you're going to want to roast them first, peel them and seed them if possible. Makes it a little more convenient or not. Then vacuum seal them and freeze them. You can, of course, ferment them. And in 2013, I fermented roasted Hatch chilies into an award-winning chili sauce.
I'm impressed. I should have known.
Well, you know, it was a contest being held by the OC Weekly and another radio station, which I will not name.
Okay, gotcha. Wonderful. Well, we have about, maybe 10 minutes left. Not quite. What other subjects would you like to talk about?
Well, we've mentioned pressure canning mm-hmm. a little bit, mm-hmm. and I think pressure canning is one of the most important types of food preservation. It does require specialized equipment. It does require a pressure canner. Not a pressure cooker, a pressure canner. A pressure canner can be a pressure cooker. A pressure cooker is not a pressure canner. So we want to make sure that you're using a pressure canner. A handy device to have in the house, by the way, because it can also be used as a pressure cooker. And pressure cooking is a great way to make a lot of different meals much more quickly and even extract more nutrition. For example, I use my pressure canner to make chicken stock and beef stock. And because of the higher temperatures and pressures achieved by a pressure canner, you actually extract more nutrition and flavor from the bones. So you get a higher quality product. In fact, many of the top restaurants are using them now to make their stocks. It's also a much quicker process, whereas a beef stock might require, you know, a dozen hours of simmering on the stove and a lot of energy. If you do a pressure canned beef stock, pressure cooked beef stock, it takes just an hour. And you're extracting the same amount of gelatin and everything else because of the higher pressures. So a handy device to have, a little bit of an investment, but a handy device. And you can get a decent pressure canner for $60 to $100. There are, you know, other models that range in price, more bells and whistles. But you can get a decent one for $60 to $100. And I highly recommend buying a new one, because if you buy an old one, you don't know whether what kind of abuse it's taken and whatnot. So it's best probably to invest in a new one. And the reason I like pressure canning is pressure canning is the only way that we can can things like beans, meats, soups. And this is important. In water bath canning, we do jams, jellies, pickles. Don't get me wrong, I love these. A pickle on every plate, I say. But there's only so much jam and jelly you can actually eat. And again, pickles are more of a condiment. You know, mm-hmm. It's not the main part of the meal. You're not going to generally eat, you know, a full bowl of kosher dill pickles for breakfast or lunch. You can if you want. I'm not the boss of you. But pressure canning is where, you know, we can get feed our family. And it's a great way to economize. I could put up a pint jar of pinto beans for 35 to 40 cents. Whereas if, you know, I'm getting it from the store, I'm lucky to pay 75 cents on a super sale. Mm-hmm. Mostly it's going to be $1.50 at least, and even higher. Also, I know exactly what went into those pinto beans.
Yeah.
Not a lot of other additives or anything like that. I can also flavor the pinto beans if I want to make them just the way I like it. I can can chili. And I'm sorry, the canned chili that's on the market, none of it really suits my taste. But I make my own canned chili beans. And I make them just the way I want to eat them. It's also a great labor-saving device because, or labor-shifting device. It takes some effort and time to can. But after a long day at work, overtime, I'm tired. Well, I don't want to cook. Well, I could go to fast food. But I could also just come home and crack open a can of my own chili beans, heat it up in the microwave, maybe put a little chopped fresh onion, a little cheddar cheese on there. And I've got a wonderful meal. I know exactly where it came from. It suits my taste perfectly. Or canned soups. Now, there are restrictions on what kind of soups you can and what certain ingredients can go in soups or not. But, you know, I can crack open a can of my, you know, split pea soup with ham. It suits my taste exactly. You know, give me some fresh bread on the side, a little bit of butter. I'm good to go.
Oh, I think with that I'm good to go, too. Ernest, this has just been wonderful. I thank you so much for being with us. And I really, really, really appreciate that. And if anybody's interested in following Ernest Miller, you could see him at RLM Provisions, excuse me, and follow him on Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest. He also has some incredible canning jars at Etsy.com. That's ETSY.com if you're interested. You can probably just Google you too, right? Ernest Miller, chef?
Yes, Ernest Miller, chef. If you Google just Ernest Miller, you're going to get a retired professional wrestler. But Ernest Miller, chef will come right to me. Also, by the way, Ernest Miller Hemingway. You may have heard of him. He wrote some books. I don't know.
There you go. No relations or relations?
No relations.
No relations. Well, Ernest, thank you so much for being with us today. And also, you could also, if you can't remember all that I'm telling you and you're interested in master food preserving, you can look up, go to the Google Master Food Preservers, Orange County, and our site should pop up. So I thank you very much for being with us, Ernest, and I thank the audience for listening. And I know I'm going to go home and start working on some new things. So thank you again, and I hope everybody has a wonderful day.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you.